calling the meeting of the Tompkins County Legislature to order. Please join me in the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. Roll call of members. And everyone, please remember to center your microphones and speak into them. Thank you.
Dan Klein.
Here.
Ann Corman.
Present.
Mike Lane.
Here.
Dave McKenna. Glenn Morey.
Here.
Martha Robertson.
Here.
Leslie Schill. Mike Sigler.
Here.
Shauna Black. Amanda Champion.
Here.
Deborah Dawson.
Here.
Henry Granison.
Present.
Rich John.
Here.
Leslyn McBean Claiborne.
Present.
We have 13 members present.
Thank you. Presentation of proclamations, petitions, communications, and notices. You would have received your communications. I have one proclamation, which I will read. And this is a proclamation in recognition of the 200th anniversary of the First Baptist Church of Ithaca. It reads, whereas the First Baptist Church was founded by the 23 people in Danby following the harvest season of 1821, 5 years later, in 1826, the church moved a few miles north to Ithaca, and in 1831, with a young Ezra Cornell serving as one of the carpenters, the first home of the First Baptist Church was constructed and remained the home of the church until it was destroyed by fire in 1854, at which time a second structure was built and used faithfully until it was outgrown by the congregation and required a larger building. And whereas, in 1890, the building of the current structure was completed with the financial assistance of John D. Rockefeller and the architect design of William Henry Miller, who also designed major buildings on the campus of Cornell University and in downtown Ithaca. And whereas the structure, widely recognized as an example of Romanesque architecture, has often been referred to as the jewel of DeWitt Park, and in 1971 was designated a historic landmark by the Landmarks Preservation Commission of the City of Ithaca and listed in the New York State and National Registers of Historic Landmarks. And whereas, from its inception, the First Baptist Church has been involved in strategic ministries that included the church becoming a center for women's suffrage movement in upstate New York in the late 19th century. And in 1902, a meeting of the Tompkins County Suffrage Association took place in the church parlor. In 1914, a mass meeting of suffragettes from 9 counties met at the church. The First Baptist Church was willing to take that risk because it saw the marginalization of women as a biblical justice issue. And whereas the First Baptist Church was willing to stand up and be counted during the civil rights turmoil in the 1950s and 1960s, and its members met with members of the Calvary Baptist Church of Ithaca, traditionally a black congregation church, to affirm the message of Martin Luther King Jr. And whereas the first Planned Parenthood office and clinic was housed in the First Baptist Church during the 1970s, and the pastor, as a board and congregation member, supervised a clinic that helped establish an education program, and prior to Roe v. Wade decision, the pastor of the First Baptist Church was part of a clergy service to provide assistance to women in locating a safe abortion. And whereas in the 1980s, the church joined with the Quakers as leaders of the sanctuary movement in the Ithaca area, calling upon the U.S. government to acknowledge the right of Salvadoran and Guatemalan refugees to political asylum, and declared its opposition to the deportation of refugees as long as persecution, torture, and murder of civilians continued. And whereas the First Baptist Church has been a champion of inclusiveness for decades and has long been a home to members of the LGBTQ plus community, is a member of the Association of Welcoming and Affirming Baptists, which is committed to the inclusion of lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender persons in the full life and mission of Baptist churches. And whereas, in 2007, the church joined the Tompkins County Workers Center to aid in the campaign for a living wage for all workers, and the First Baptist Church is a living wage employer. Now, therefore, I, Leslyn McLean Claiborne, Chair of the Tompkins County Legislature, do hereby recognize and join in the celebration of the 200th anniversary of the First Baptist Church of Ithaca, signed this 21st day of September, 2021. And you can clap now. Yay. Is there anyone here to accept this proclamation? Anyone from the church here? We're checking. If not, is there anyone else here who would like to accept this proclamation who has affiliation with the First Baptist Church? That's fine. If not, we will make sure that a signed, sealed copy of it is delivered to our neighbors. So thank you very much for that. I want to very quickly go to, we will have an executive session tonight. Point fleets are privileged of the floor for the public, municipal officials, legislators, and then I need to do a little rearranging of the agenda. So, privilege of the floor for the public. I have one person who signed up to speak with us tonight. And, oh, Zachary Wynn.
Good evening. My name is Zachary Wynn. I emailed the legislature the text of a comment made by a Tompkins County sheriff. I believe you all have received that. I spoke about it at the recent public safety meeting, and I would encourage you all to examine it closely. I have also been endeavoring to find out exactly how many overdoses have been occurring in Tompkins County since the July public safety meeting, where CompStat numbers showing a 100% increase in overdoses year on year has been going on. The numbers available from the health department website are months old and will not be fully compiled until next year. My inquiries into exactly what substances are causing the overdoses and what drug people think they are doing when they do overdose have been met with no success. I would like to know, if fentanyl is being found in suspected cocaine and heroin seized by Tompkins County law enforcement. I believe this information is important for the public to have, especially if the answer is yes. There are 20,000 students who have returned to town, and it is easy to imagine a situation where a half dozen students are overdosing on tainted cocaine. If this manner of testing on seized drugs is not being performed by Thompson County law enforcement, I request that funds be made available for the testing of the contents of seized narcotics and for that information to be made available to the public. I yield the remainder of my time. Thank you.
Thank you, Zachary Wynn. Is there anyone else? All right. Municipal officials. I see Duxon. Welcome, Duxon. Alder person representing the second ward in the city of Ithaca.
Of Ithaca.
Good evening.
Good evening.
So planning and economic development. George gave you an update of our last council meeting. Planning and economic development met last week with a couple of proposed pieces of legislation that the public might be interested in. One of which is a right to counsel, providing tenants with access to legal services when they go before eviction court, and another good cause eviction, also known as right to renew, giving tenants the default right to renew a lease, barring any, you know, illegal activity or a list of other issues that might give the landlord good cause to evict the tenant. I also hear that modeled after the town's short-term rental legislation, something will be coming to PEDC in the months to come. So that's another controversial bit that'll be before us soon. Tomorrow, we are meeting as a committee of the whole, all of council meeting to discuss 5G and other wireless facilities legislation, zoning basically, and design guidelines. And what else? The reimagined public safety issue, effort is continuing. We're still doing call type classification in terms of what should, you know, solicit a armed or unarmed or alternative response. And I wanted to note that the 2022 sidewalk plan for the city of Ithaca is out. And if you have any, if you want to see it and have any comments that you want to give, just Google Ithaca sidewalk program. The 2022 plan is there. The contact info for John Lasitra, who administers that program, is there. And so if there are sections of sidewalk that the public feels needs to be addressed and that's not on this year's list, they should let him know. I will note that over the 7 or so years that the program has been in place, the fees collected by the program have purchased successively shorter segments of, you know, fewer linear feet of sidewalk as the cost of labor and materials has gone up. And so just my opinion, that the rates will have to go up. You know, we should at least discuss the increase of rates in the time to come so we can actually keep up with the amount of sidewalk we have in the city. And that's it for me.
Thank you, Dustin. Are there any questions for Dustin or comments? Martha?
Thank you, Leslyn. Thank you, Dustin. Good to see you. Can you give us any update on what the city is doing with American Rescue Plan's funds it's gotten, and how's council involved?
I can't because we have not been involved, and I think our controller and the mayor are still working that out. I expect some kind of direction at our first October meeting. That's another thing I should have mentioned is our budget season will kick off in a couple of weeks with the October council meeting when the mayor presents his budget.
So you expect something about ARPA to come up in that context?
I do, yeah.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Duxon. Anybody else? Henry?
Yes, thank you, Duxon. I had two questions. One is, what's the city doing about redistricting?
That's another thing that we have not started. I asked the mayor about this recently because I saw that the county had started its effort. We're a little behind, so I need to catch up with them and see what we are doing. Currently nothing.
Okay. Okay. in terms of short-term rentals, you said that it would be after the town, although the town hasn't passed a short-term rental, and I guess they're still deciding. So what's the city looking at?
I mean, it's very, very initial, but discussions will almost inevitably start with the town's proposal or be modeled after the town's proposal, which I haven't been able to keep up, but, you know, something like 30 days of unhosted rentals, for example, as a start, and unlimited hosted rentals. So again, yeah, you're exactly right. They haven't passed anything yet, and we would prefer to act with some consistency with them.
Okay, yeah, I know the town is also worrying about that the chamber and other people have said about the lakefront rentals, that they don't want those to be under the same requirement.
Right. I mean, they have a long history of those being rentals, and we don't have that problem, at least not as much.
Okay. Thanks.
All right. Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Dixon. Appreciate it. This is a point where we get to privilege the floor for legislators, and I wanted to use this particular opportunity right now as we talk of legislators to remember a former colleague, Peter Stein, who passed away recently. And I want to just ask your indulgence for a moment of silence in remembrance of Peter and all the great work he did both in politics as well as his work at Cornell and in the community. Please join me in a moment of silence to Peter. Thank you. May you rest in peace, Peter. Legislators, I also want to just allow an opportunity and space if anyone wanted to share any thoughts quickly, anything just around our colleague, Peter. Mike Lane.
I was proud to have been able to serve with Peter on this legislature, known him for many, many years. He thought differently than most of us. He was a scientist. He was a physicist. He taught physics. He did the math when we had problems. And sometimes politics got in the way of a mathematical solution, not with him, but with the rest of us. And I know that was always a different way for him to have to deal other than just the scientific method about various things. But he made us think about things, and he cared about people. He did things like gave rides to people to visit inmates in the Tompkins County Jail. He didn't have to do things like that. He was devoted to his family. His wife was Irene Stein, was a former director of our Office for the Aging. And we'll miss Peter. I'm sorry when he went off the legislature, we were sorry to see him go, but understood. And I wish him peace.
Thank you, Mike. Rich?
I would just say when I joined the legislature, Peter was entirely welcoming. He really went out of his way to help explain how this august body operates and answer any questions I had. He was really good about that. And I also would just offer the recollection of when he told us about opera. And Peter was passionate about opera. And I didn't know that until he held the floor for quite a bit of time telling us everything about opera. But it was really entertaining, and I will miss him.
Thank you, Rich. Anyone else? Martha?
Thank you, Leslyn, and thank you for bringing that moment of silence for us all to remember Peter. He did hold the floor sometimes for a long time, but he was a great storyteller. I think 50 years of teaching, he really knew how to tell a story and keep an audience. He never shied away from a fight, if that's, you know, not a fight, but from a vigorous debate. I think he loved it most when we didn't all agree on something. A couple of his major passions on the legislature were TCAT. He himself was an avid walker and bus rider, so he loved serving on the TCAT board, and LEAD, Law Enforcement Assisted Diversion, was one of those issues that he grabbed it in his teeth, and he really was really passionate about trying to get that set up in our county. It was always fun to listen to Peter. I drove to and from Lake Placid for NYSAC meetings, for NYSAC conference with him one time, and his stories were just fascinating. I always learned something from Peter. He will be sorely missed. His obituary is in the online version of the Ithaca Journal. I didn't see it in the printed paper yet, but it's a truly impressive and warm and lovely story about Peter's life, and I encourage people to take a look. He did have wonderful accomplishments in research and teaching that we're just not aware of, but he served the community with all his heart, and we deeply appreciate his work.
Thank you, Martha. Shauna?
Yeah, I actually remember the first time that I met Peter. We met at the Ithaca Bakery, and I had set up the appointment in order to meet with him and ask him some questions about the legislature. And the first words that he said to me were, "So you're the lesbian that's running for the legislature," which I thought was highly inappropriate, but it was very much so Peter, and I appreciated that. You know, from there, we built a relationship. And another story is that I had an uncontested race. And so I told Peter, you know what, let's go out and let's meet some of our Republicans. And he was like, that's a great idea. And so we hopped in the car, and every Saturday I'd pick him up at his house, and we would go and we'd knock on doors of our Republican friends. And I remember looking at Peter and I said, you know what, wouldn't it be amazing if one of these Republicans actually voted for me? And he looked me dead in the eye and said, don't count on it. And I, you know, I of course thought that was pretty funny too. You know, as Peter, moved into Kendall and started to decline, the one thing I would stop in and drop him off some of his favorite cookies from the Ithaca Bakery. And the one thing that continued to be constant was his love for his wife and his family. And, that's something that I always, always admired Peter for. All of his grandchildren, he ended up taking an international trip with him, and he always, always held those memories like so special to him, and remembered, the faintest of details. And, I just know that his family was the world to him. And so I hope Peter is resting in peace.
Thank you, Shauna. Deborah, and then Jonathan.
Thank you, Leslyn. Yeah, I didn't have an opportunity to get to know Peter very well, but I did get to know Irene. And I know that Peter's devotion to Irene and his family was mutual. And in addition to our good memories of Peter, I know that we all send our condolences and
yes,
and love to Irene and the family as well.
Thank you, Deborah. Yes, we do. Jonathan.
So two short stories about Peter, who I got to know very well. One of which, we had this issue once on whether to have green shoulders or not as a traffic calming measure. And Peter wanted to do an objective study. And he did a truly objective study, which the highway department did. And someone asked me, and said, and we're always talking about having, you know, the legislature making objective decisions based on data. And someone asked me, said, so do you think the results of this study will make any difference in how anybody votes? And I said, yes, Peter Stein. Because Peter was the most truly objectively, you know, at least what he viewed as objective. He really tried to be objective, and he really was in that way, like no one else on the legislature. Another story is that there is this report that was given to the legislature. Some of you remember it. And it was by a group that was anti-fracking, and everybody thought it was great. And Peter thought the science was really bad. And Peter actually prepared a very long, like an hour presentation to give to the legislature, which he came and gave to me at one point. And I was like, Peter, you can't give that. You know, first of all, they're not going to sit there for an hour. And secondly, nobody's going to agree with you. People agree with them. And he goes, but they're wrong. They're wrong. And the long story is, I know Peter was right. Peter was right. But you can't tell other people that. But Peter was really, you know, he was devoted to what he thought was right. And even when it would be politically incorrect, you'd really have to convince Peter, said Peter, you know, sometimes you got to be, you know, just deal with the fact that other people aren't going to be as objective as you are. So I really like Peter for those reasons.
Thank you so very much, Jonathan. And you're right. And Peter was right. Peter was right. And it didn't matter what else you said. And we had similar conversations like you mentioned, Shauna, around issues of diversity and inclusion. Peter was right. Peter was right. And Peter always wanted the data and the facts to prove it. Otherwise, it doesn't matter. You know, if the data doesn't support it, it doesn't matter. So echoing what Deborah says to Irene and Peter's family, know that this legislature sent our full condolences. And we certainly do honor and respect the work that Peter has done, not only in this community, regionally as well, representing us in government levels and taking Tompkins County and the work in Tompkins County to new minds and new areas, so people knew exactly what we were doing here in Tompkins County and representing us very strongly. So thank you again for indulging. Thank you for sharing some thoughts. I'm sure there'll be other opportunities to share even more. And again, Peter, wherever you are, we wish you a peaceful and powerful rest. Thank you for indulging me in shuffling the agenda a little bit. I'm going to ask Gio to Mike Sigler and Amanda Gio to move to add to the agenda a resolution.
Yeah, I'd like to make a motion that we get this on the agenda. It's the appointment of election commissioner.
Moved by Mike Sigler, seconded by Glenn Morey. Any discussion? All right, we need 10 votes to add this to the agenda. Roll call vote.
Dan Klein?
Yes.
Ann Corman?
Yes.
Mike Lane?
Yes.
Dave McKenna?
Yes.
Glenn Morey?
Yes.
Robertson?
Yes.
Leslie Show?
Yes.
Mike Sigler?
Yes.
Shauna Blass?
Yes.
Amanda Champion?
Yes.
Deborah Dawson?
Yes.
Henry Grandison?
Yes.
Rich Dunn?
Yes.
Leslie McBean Clairborn?
Yes.
14 ayes, 0 noes.
Okay, that carries. And now it's on the agenda. I'll ask for us to move that resolution.
All right. I would like to move the appointment of Election Commissioner, whereas Election Commissioner Elizabeth Cree retired effective August 16th, 2021, and whereas the Tompkins County Republican Committee at September 14th, 2021 meeting recommended Tamara M. Scott for appointment to fill the existing vacancy in said office for the remainder of the term, and whereas the Tompkins County Republican Committee at the same meeting also recommended Tamara M. Scott for appointment to a two-year term, now, therefore, be it resolved on recommendation of the Tompkins County Republican Committee and the Government Operations Committee that Tamara M. Scott be and hereby is appointed Republican Party Elections Commissioner for the remainder of the existing vacancy effective immediately into a two-year term commencing January 1st, 2022 and ending December 31st, 2023.
Thank you, Mike. Short and sweet. May I have a second? Who said that? Dave?
Dave.
Seconded by Dave. Any discussion? I know Tamara is here. In case you don't know who she is, she's been working the Board of Elections for a while. All right. Let's take it to a vote.
Dan Klein?
Yes.
Ann Corman?
Yes.
Mike Lane?
Yes.
Dave McKenna?
Yes.
Glenn Maury?
Yes.
Martha Robertson?
Yes.
Leslie Show?
Yes.
Mike Sigler?
Yes.
Shauna Black?
Yes.
Champion?
Yes.
Deborah Dawson?
Yes.
Henry Grandison?
Yes.
Rich John?
Yes.
And McBean Claiborne?
Yes.
14 ayes, 0 noes.
Thank you. That passes unanimously. Congratulations. Would you like to say something?
This is your one chance.
Thank you all for...
If I go to the microphone.
You have to use the microphone.
Thank you all for unanimous vote. I look forward to getting to know all of you a little bit better. And I am across the parking lot that way. If anybody needs to stop in or wants to visit, that'd be great. And I'm hope to be available to you as needed. And I look forward to getting to know you all. Thanks so much.
All right. Thank you again. Congratulations. All right. Let's go back then to our of the agenda. I don't have any chair's appointments. Okay. Let's go to special topic and, were there any other topics that legislators needed to speak about on the privilege of vote for the legislature? I realized that I went to Peter and didn't leave space for anything else. Sorry about that. Dan Klein?
Yeah, thank you. I just wanted to mention that the State Theater has reopened. This is exciting. This is a cultural part of our county, I would say. I happened to usher at the State Theater, and I had ushered at the Graham Nash show in February or March of 2020. Didn't know it was the last show at the time. 559 days went by till the next show, which was last weekend, which I also got to usher for. So I felt a little extra connected, kind of bookended the pandemic. So in addition to just celebrating that the theater is open and that there's more shows coming up, I also just wanted to mention that their policy is vaccination. You have to be vaccinated to get in, and you have to wear a mask the entire time you're in the theater. And it's just so obvious to me that these are the steps we need to follow if we want to get back to something like normal. And the State Theater is showing a really good example of how that can be. Thank you.
Thank you, Dan. Thank you for sharing that. Anyone else? And again, I apologize for looking at Park Martha.
Yeah, are our hands not showing when we're up to raise
them? No, it is. I'm just looking around, and when I look up at the screen, and I see you.
Okay. Thank you. I just want to report a brief report on the NYSAC conference, the fall seminar that was held last week. Henry and I went, and Deanna Carithers, our Equity and Diversity Officer, she made a presentation. Henry and I were participants, and it was it was lively. It was in Syracuse. It was almost as full, I think, in attendance as usual. The photos, there are photos, and many of the presentations are also up on the NYSAC website now. So if you'd like to, you don't see the full presentations, but you can see the slides that were at like 16 or 18 of the presentations. So there's some very useful information that's available for anybody who didn't get to go, or even if you went, you didn't get to every workshop. The plenary, there's also the full video of the plenary presentation by NASA oceanographer Dr. Bridget Seegers. That's on YouTube. You can see the whole thing, which she was really fascinating. The resolutions that NYSAC passed were, as always, a long list. But one of the primary resolutions passed by the board of directors was about Medicaid reconciliation. So that's right at the top of their lobbying list. I have the full copy of the paper copy of the resolutions if anybody wants to read them on paper. But those are also either on the website now or they will be. But those are important statements that they that NYSAC uses to lobby on behalf of the interests of counties. So one other thing is that the Climate Resiliency Committee, which I've been chairing for the last year and a half, new chair of that will be Patrick Ryan, who's county executive from Ulster County. And I really encourage some of you to pick up and become a member of that committee. We are really hoping that NYSAC will formulate it as a permanent standing committee in this coming year. And it really needs Tompkins County's participation to be strong. So those are some of the highlights, and happy to talk about any particular workshop with other folks if you're interested. Thanks.
Thank you, Martha. Henry?
Yes. Also in terms of NYSAC, they're holding the next annual meeting in March as opposed to end of January, and the hotel has been completely redone. So we'll be going to a exciting new hotel next year.
All righty. You're talking about the normal January conference?
Yes, it's the same. The January conference is in March next year.
It's not moved to March.
But the hotel has been completely renovated.
Got it. Thank you. Michaeline and then Deborah.
Two things I wanted to mention. One is TC3, the presidential search. Of course, the provost, Paul Reichenheiser, has been named as the administrator in charge during the search. The board of trustees of the college has not yet decided whether they're going to be appointing an interim president or whether they're just going to go ahead and try to find a president with a expedited search process. They are now interviewing search firms to help with that process of locating candidates for the presidency of the college. So they're taking this very seriously, naturally, and they're moving forward. The other thing I just wanted to say, muse a little bit about, we're about to turn to fall. In fact, maybe it's today we turn to fall. It's the time on the legislature when the rubber hits the road. We are already up to our ears in budget. We have had added to that the issues concerning the money that came to us from the American Rescue Plan and how we're going to deal with that. We've got searches for various positions in the county that are going on. And we are spending a lot of time on our county duties. When I say we, I'm talking about legislators, but also the people that help us so much, our administrator, interim, and also department heads and other staff members. We couldn't do it without them, but I hope folks look at their legislators and the work that they're doing. Listen to us if you have a chance when we speak and handle our business, whether it's watching it on TV or seeing the live streams. But this is a very effective legislature, and we will continue to do good work right through the end of the year. We are a team, I think the people of Tompkins County are fortunate, in my view, to have the experience of so many of you sitting around this table. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike. That was really nicely done. Thank you. Deborah.
Ah, shucks, Mike. Of course not. I want to harken back to the item that Henry reported on. My personal perspective is that those January conferences that NYSAC holds are exceptionally valuable because it gives us a heads up on what direction the state budget is going on. If they wait until March to give us that information, it's not going to give us enough time to really mount any kind of effective lobbying effort. Did they say anything about, having some sort of mechanism to give us that budget update in January?
No, they did not, although I suspect that they were also thinking that we could basically have more of an input on the budget, because by having it in January, we're dealing with theoretical stuff that may not get passed or may not get considered by March. And so that we would, I don't know the exact dates of the conference, but I know it's like mid-March or something, or later March. And so we would be able to lobby the representatives, while it's just before the deadline.
Yeah, but doesn't it have to be passed by April 1st?
Yes.
It doesn't give us very much time.
But the key time is sort of the last half of March is when the rubber hits the road. So I guess that's the logic. But Martha can also speak.
Well, we're not going to solve the problem of when NYSAC puts its conference at this meeting. Chances are we can ask the executives of NYSAC what were they thinking and bring up the same question that you brought up. Otherwise, we'll all just be speculating for the rest of the night about what could and could not happen. So I appreciate the conversation around it, but we're going to move on. Any other legislators on the privilege of the floor? Okay. We have a couple of special presentations tonight. Thank you to our presenters for joining us, starting with the Cornell Cooperative Extension Food System Plan update. And I do believe Don Barber is here for that. Thank you, Don. Good to see you.
Thank you. Do I have to do anything to share the screen?
Should be a green button on the bottom. You'll be able to click that. Then you just choose the document you'd like to share.
Doing it.
All right. And then you can press present. From beginning on the top left.
Here we go. All right. Everybody hear me?
Yeah.
So good. All right. So I'm Don Barber, and I'm the chair of the Food Policy Council of Tompkins County. And good evening to everyone, and thank you for this opportunity to update this legislature on the food system plan work that's been done by the Food Policy Council in cooperation with Cooperative Extension. 2 years ago, I sat right here asking you to fund the food system plan development for Tompkins County through an over-target request. Like air and water, food is necessary to survive. 2 years ago, you agreed that having a community-supported food system plan was good government policy. These were the four main reasons for having a food system plan. They're still valid today, maybe even more so. A food system plan can provide a common vision and collective energy to strengthen the local food economy, take proactive steps to mitigate climate change, and ensure an equitable food system where all residents have access to nutritious food, improved diet, and health. That original target request was the basis for the food system vision, and this is one that we have put together to build a food system that is sustainable, equitable, healthy, and affordable for all members of this community. And I should try to minimize this little beauty over here. So the both the county legislature, I should mention that 2 years ago when I asked you for funds to support a part-time coordinator with Cooperative Extension picking up the benefits, we hired Katie Stoner-Hallis, who many of you may know, and Katie has done a terrific job and also had her second child. You also made it clear that you wanted the Food Policy Council to go beyond the county for funding for the program activities. The Community Foundation of Tompkins County has supported our program activities with grants totaling $444,000. So the county legislature and community foundation both requested that we engage community in our work. And here's a summary of the connections that we've made. We have 46 volunteers that serve on our food system planning team, and many more in our working groups that are reviewing the reports. These are the community partners that we've engaged with over the past year and a half.
Can you hold that slide a little bit?
Thank you.
Can you just hold that slide a little bit, go back to the community partners? Just give us a little bit, yeah. Thank you, I can't see. What's on the bottom on the area farmers pantries? Community members. Okay. Thank you.
Sure. So we've had two community events bookending the pandemic, one in February 2020 and another one coming up next week to engage the community with the work that we're doing. We've worked on surveys, a food access questionnaire, and a community needs food needs survey. You can see the number of responders we've had to those surveys. We've had countless conversations with community members, over 60 in-depth interviews with stakeholders, 15 in-person conversations with food pantry clients. And we've engaged the media with our work. These are the funders: the legislature, the community foundation, in-kind staff support from Cooperative Extension, and in-kind staff support from the Recycling and Materials Management Office of Tompkins County. So with community input, we identified the vulnerabilities, challenges, and assets of our local food system. We are taking great pains to capture their stories in their words to share with the community. For the next phase of the plan development, we are going back out to the community, both for those who informed our work to date and hopefully many more, to articulate recommendations for the food system plan. And we are asking for one more over-target request to provide the resources to begin implementing the plan, which I will discuss later. This is our work plan that we've had to date, and you can see that we have baseline assessments, summaries for production infrastructure, food environment, and so on, and I will be discussing those, giving you brief summaries on those. You can also see the data sources that we've used up to now, as well as our food system logo that we have on our website. We'll see the website listed. So the information I'm sharing is on the website, as well as the executive summaries for the baseline sections that are up in the upper left-hand corner. So our work plan for this right now is September 29th, we're having a community event. We'll share line baseline assessment findings with the community at a fall kickoff, which is at 5 p.m. at the Ithaca Farmers Market, so that's next Wednesday. This fall and winter, we have ongoing community events that we'll be holding and to get plan goals and recommendations In the spring, we'll be drafting recommendations that we will be consistently taking out to community members. And in May of next year, our goal is to bring to this legislature our food system plan recommendations. So this is the food production landscape. This is a summary of the data that we've gathered. We've found that labor cost is high. We have a limited labor pool, a shortage of farmers for the next generation. Our producers financially struggle. Off-farm income is needed, and regulations impede in profitability. We've learned that access to retailers, distributors and processes and business support is lacking for our production folks. We've learned that access to land is difficult due to systemic racism and inequalities, also high land prices and development pressures. We've learned that climate change has significant impacts, requiring time and energy for mitigation and adaption. And all of these hurdles are very high for new and beginning farmers. So this is our food infrastructure. In addition to production and processing, food infrastructure includes transportation, storage, tracking systems, and inventory management. Nationally, 85 to 90% of the food that we eat is processed, produced, and distributed, marketed by agribusiness conglomerates. We estimate that Tompkins County residents annually spend about $875 million on food. We are trying to learn how much of that food money leaves Tompkins County and or stays in Tompkins County, and that's a project we're continuing to work on. We did learn that local distributors source from local farms. The bulk of our producers are small and lack storage and processing infrastructure. We've learned, for example, that the lack of USDA meat processing sites means small farms are setting appointments for their meat cutting to be done 1 year out. This slide captures the food environment, the work that we've done. So what is food environment? It's workers, it's perceptions, it's the power of the larger players, it's institutions, purchasing impacts, and it's retailers. Some of the challenges we've learned are that food service workers feel undervalued, lack visibility, and support. We've learned that multinational agribusiness conglomerates control supply chains from production through retail and even space on the grocery shelves. This creates a food system of vulnerabilities which were made very vivid during the pandemic. Vulnerability is also caused by extreme climate and geopolitical struggles, which impact small retailers and at-risk populations the most. We've learned that hiring and retention are significant challenges for local food retailers. Most retailers do not pay a living wage because food prices are driven down by agribusiness. And we've learned that agribusiness corporations require purchasing agreements that restrict local retailers' ability to buy local. Also, federal regulations designed by conglomerate lobbyists create additional barriers for local producers who would benefit from accessing larger markets. And being in a cold weather climate with short growing season creates challenges for retailers and restaurants trying to source local products. Food access and security is where our group has spent the bulk of its attention during the past year and a half. Food security means always having both physical and economic access to sufficient, safe, and nutritious foods. Our food travels an average of 1,500 miles to our plate. For a host of reasons, our food is 17% more expensive than the national average, which puts an additional burden on low-income residents. 11.6% of our residents are food insecure, and one-third of those residents are not eligible for SNAP. Our community has told us that time for food and shopping, for food shopping and preparation is a limitation. They have limited access to nutritious, fresh and culturally appropriate food. And the spectrum of transportation-related issues disrupt food access and security for them as well. Food insecurity is inherently tied to other structural factors, such as income, wealth, racism and classism, disabilities, housing and transportation insecurity. You discover that racial disparities in food assistance enrollment show higher levels of food insecurity among Black residents, which is layered on top of the lowest rates of income and highest rates of poverty in the county. It was confirmed that emergency food agencies help residents access food. And for all of us, pervasive climate uncertainty promises food uncertainty and system instability going forward. Warming, extreme weather events, flooding and drought lead to disruption of food production and distribution. The food plants is further compromised when 75% of our food comes from just 12 plants and animals. Dietary patterns, food culture, availability, and disposable income affect what we eat, and that impacts our community's health, economy, and environment. People want healthy food for everyone, but even when those identify good food as healthy food, still don't consume enough fruits and vegetables. Another challenge that we've identified is that there is still a lot of consumer confusion about how to eat sustainably. Previous slides showed how precious food is, especially nutritious food. Yet 35% of the food we purchase is never eaten. Food is the largest component of our waste stream, and as a waste, it is a major source of the greenhouse gas methane. Locally, we are doing a good job of diverting food waste from landfills and incinerators. Also, the Friendship Donation Network rescues 1,400 pounds per day of food. This might list some of the barriers and opportunities that we have with the waste stream. On this high-level summary, I trust you can appreciate all the work that has been done to document our current food system. Hundreds of pages exist that we've gathered. I hope you will go to our website and see the executive summaries that we've prepared. We have a solid foundation of info to bring to our community and to blend with their vision for the food system plan that we'll be bringing forward to you. So moving forward, as I promised, I would update you on our over-target request in next year's budget. We are requesting funds for a half-time position to provide energy and coordination to bring portions of our food system plan to fruition. By connecting with local governments on policy decisions, including the City of Ithaca's Green New Deal, and connecting with food collaborators. That's how we intend to bring many of these recommendations to fruition. We also want to create a food system dashboard that connects producers, institutions, food insecurity agencies, and consumers with regular food system updates. These dashboards exist other places around the country and in New York State, and we feel would be much of value to our county and community. And we want to capture the energy and work of our community that has gone into creating the food system plan by creating a Tompkins County food charter. By gathering charter member signatures and seeking food system sponsors, who are now aware of the critical need for a food system plan that is equitable, affordable, and sustainable, as well as healthy. We hope that they will provide funding for going forward. I want to thank you for the ongoing support of the county. Please join us at our event on September 29th, next Wednesday at 5 p.m. at the Ithaca Farmers Market to hear more and to learn and to contribute your ideas to the plan. Also, we'll be presenting to TCOG in October to bring other local governments into the process. So I'll end there and take any questions or comments. And I also have Monica Roth back here. So, who actually is very good at answering these questions.
Thank you, John, and thank you, Monica, for being here as well. Questions? Ann?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Don and Monica and all the other people that have worked on this. I just wanted to mention that, which was clarified to me before, that this is not Cooperative Extension that's doing this. This is its own entity, the Food Policy. That's the name of it, the Food?
Food Policy Council.
Food Policy Council. So I just wanted to clarify that. And you've done tremendous amount of work. Every time I read or look at it, I see something else. So something else that stands out to me. So one thing I just wanted to ask is, so is some of the data that you're putting in here, like food waste is the largest, food is the largest component of waste in landfills. The estimated 35% of all food produced is not eaten. Are those type of things indicative for this county or just national statistics?
We're getting this information from the recycling and material handling group. So that's the source. And I believe that because they're monitoring our waste and so on, that they're probably using national data, but they're also keep tracking what we're doing locally.
Okay.
Yep.
Thank you.
Sure.
Mike Lane.
So many interesting facts. It was chock full of them, Don. Thank you. The one sticks in my mind, and why are we going to lose 52% of the wheat production?
Why are we going to?
Yeah, why is that going to happen?
Because of the climate change that's happening in the Midwest where our breadbasket is that creates that.
Are we heading for another Dust Bowl?
Is it again?
Think we'll be heading for another Dust Bowl?
No, I don't believe that's the case, but they are, most of their water pumps from the Oglala Aquifer.
Yep.
And as the temperatures warm, they're pumping more out. So there's, the projection is in 50 years that, there'll be a significant reduction, that we'll be producing nationally. Of course, we can still import from other countries, so, assuming that they're still able to produce. But the wheat has a certain sweet spot in the climate that we're moving out of.
Thank you.
Sure.
Thank you. Martha Robertson.
Thank you, Leslie. Thank you, John. Although I can't see you, it's good to hear you. Two questions. One is, you probably remember that IAED had a something called the Food BIP, the Business Incubator Program for agricultural businesses, for entrepreneurs. Have you folks been in touch? I believe that project is over, but I'm sure they have a lot of contacts and important information to share. I don't know if you've been in touch with them about that.
So I don't know that we have, but I'm writing that down as a note to make sure that we do. Thank you, Martha.
And I'm afraid the woman who led that up, her name escapes me, so I can't help you there, but Heather will know. And then I've heard a lot about the corn in our county, that much of it is used for ethanol. So not used for food at all, but for energy. Do you have any sense of that or any way to track or measure that?
So having, being a farmer and knowing that a lot of the corn that's grown goes to cows, I'm not sure much of it in Tompkins County is going to ethanol. It's providing food for the dairy industry that's really not centralized in Tompkins County, but just north of us, there's quite a bit of it, and it's heading up that way. So I'm not aware that much of the corn is being sold as a commodity for ethanol.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Sure.
Thank you. All the questions, comments? Henry? Henry, we can't hear you.
I'm not on mute.
We can hear you now.
Okay. Don, I assume there's on your website other links to the other food dashboards on your website?
So we do not have links to other food dashboards on our website. I will say that members of Cooperative Extension have been working on this for a couple of years and are collaborating statewide to on getting our information into a statewide dashboard. But it was very clear during the pandemic when we had the food task force that was working to connect producers that had food that they couldn't get rid of with people that needed it so desperately that a food dashboard would be very important to have. And as we talked through that idea with our different partners, everybody's looking for real-time data. Our smaller farmers are more easily adapt to real data about the food system needs than the larger conglomerates. And so we think the food system dashboard is a real advantage for the producers in our community.
Can you send me links to other food dashboards?
I'd be happy to. Thank you for asking.
Thanks.
All right. Anyone else? Very interesting stats shared, Don, and I'll definitely be looking at it myself. All right, I didn't miss anybody. Thank you again. Thank you, Don. Thank you, Monica. I remember when you came here about this, and I, like many others, weren't sure what you were talking about. Food Policy Council unfunded, huh? And now we see the work that's being done, so much appreciated.
And this was kind of a primer for the work that we'd be bringing. So,
yeah. Yeah, great. Oh, thank you very much. Okay. We have one more presentation this evening. I can't see anything. And this is the historical statue presentation from the county historian, Carol Cannon.
Thank you so much for having us. This is a report from the Tompkins County Historical Commission. And I'd like to thank Michael Lane, who's a part of it, because he helped set up our program today, and he's been a valued member of the commission. I'm here with two things tonight. One is that the commission is trying to support the research and publication of historical materials for the people. And I don't know if you can see this, but hot off the press is Political Tompkins. And the whole title is Presidential Elections in Tompkins County Since 1828 by Joe Mariani. And I'd like to congratulate Joe. It's a beautiful piece of work, and we will make sure each one of you gets a copy of it. Thank you. Well, we're very excited about it. It's a wonderful piece of work, and you will be surprised. I was very surprised about some of the findings. The other piece of our presentation tonight, I'm going to turn over to Joe because he knows how to do magic things. We don't have graphics as pretty as the food people, but we have nice pictures.
Well, hello, everybody. It's good to see you again. It seems like just yesterday that we saw you. I'm going to try to screen share here. Are you able to see my screen?
Bill, we're seeing your internet browser. Just when you share it, click off to the PowerPoint you're looking to share.
Yeah. Oh, here we go.
Magic things, yes.
Yeah. Here we go. You know, I listened to Mike Lane describing the difficulty of what's facing you over the next couple of months and how tough your decisions are going to be. And I think we're going to provide you a very brief respite from all that tonight, because we're here not to really sell anything or ask for another major decision, but to inform you about something that is coming from the Historical Commission that we find very exciting, not only for the commission and for the county, but for the entire community. And we'd like to just explain very quickly tonight what we're talking about. We don't really need to tell you too much about who we are as a commission. We kind of refreshed that last night, but you know that we were created in 2018 by the legislature that gave the commission a fairly broad mandate in terms of what it hoped to see from the commission. It's a 12-person body plus our chair, the county historian, Carol Kamen. So the Historical Commission meets every other month. And a little over a year ago, in the wake of the killing of George Floyd and the destruction or attack on a number of monuments all over the country,
The commission had a very robust discussion about the future of monuments. What should they be? Should we have monuments in the future? If so, who should they honor? And it was really a fantastic discussion in a very civil forum about what we should consider when we think about monuments in the future. The group came to a fairly quick consensus, indicating that there is a need for monuments. We do need to celebrate important parts of our community and people who have lived here. And a consensus also around who should be the subjects of those monuments, and found that they should be people who represent the values of the community, who've been a part of our community. So not necessarily somebody who was a valued national figure, but somebody who was a part of our community and that has had some shape on our history. And not in the sense of a battlefield commander or something like that. It can be a smaller impact on the community, but someone who shaped our history and someone who, or a theme that has been overlooked or undervalued historically. So from that discussion came a very clear sense of what we ought to be looking for in the future. That discussion coincided very quickly with a remarkable funding opportunity. A donor who has asked to remain anonymous has made a major commitment of funding for monuments in our community. And I won't be coy, the amount is large. It's $500,000. The donor has said that the funds should be used to design and place two statues in the community. And there are some soft restrictions on those. That the monument should be sculpted by an artist who has national recognition. The donor has a real commitment to public art and the beauty of the community, and realizes that that is enhanced with an acclaimed artist. It also is a part of a community's tourism portfolio, an attraction that could draw people to the community, or once they're here, provide another attraction for our tourists. The donor also has said that the subject should reflect the progressive values of the community, very much in keeping with what the commission had indicated, should honor those who are otherwise marginalized, underrepresented, underrecognized. And again, very much in keeping with what the discussion had produced within the commission itself, and to celebrate those who have spent at least a part of their lives in Tompkins. To organize this opportunity, how do you take the next steps? The commission formed very informally a steering committee to begin discussing how we bring this to fruition. It included four members. Caroline and I are both on it. Someone you know well, Leslie McBean Claiborne, has volunteered to help. Someone who you don't know as well, perhaps, is George Boyer, who's a professor of economic history at Cornell. So this little group has been pursuing the opportunity, and very quickly, after exploring the availability of local artists, Carol reached out to someone who is really among the most acclaimed artists and sculptors in the country, Meredith Bergman, on the outside chance that she would be willing to take on a commission like this. Meredith Bergman, it meets that test of being an acclaimed artist. And I'll show you a couple examples of her work, but they include the Women's Rights Pioneers Monument, which was placed in Central Park a year ago to commemorate the centennial of the 19th Amendment ratification. It's the first statue to be placed in Central Park since 1965, and it's the only statue in Central Park that depicts women who actually lived. She has also produced a statue of Rosa Parks that's in the collection at the U.S. Capitol, the Boston Women's Memorial in Boston. And again, I'll show you some pictures of these. Memorial to County Cullen. It's in the library that's also named after him, a part of the New York City library system. This will give you an idea of the quality of Meredith Bergman's work. This is the women's rights pioneers in Central Park. You can see that if your eyes are better than mine, it honors Sojourner Truth, Susan B. Anthony, and Elizabeth Cady. You get a sense of the artistry by these close-up views of that same statue. The work of Rosa Parks that's in the U.S. Capitol. This is the Boston Women's Memorial. It's located in Boston's Commonwealth Avenue Mall. I think one thing to look at here is the life-size statues, and she makes more monumental pieces as well, but the life-size statues really invite interaction with the public, and she's made that a point of her work. In a very similar way, the County Cullen statue. There's placed in the library a statue of Marian Anderson at Converse College. You'll see a picture here of Meredith Bergman, the sculptor, who has agreed to take the commission in Tompkins. Another work of hers, Ruth Bader Ginsburg. This is the newest of her works. It's the FDR Hope Memorial. I think it was recently unveiled. It's on Roosevelt Island in New York City. And the last example, pretty powerful. It's her response to the September 11th attacks, done relatively soon after those occurred. So to make this move forward, we have had a discussion with INHS, and INHS has agreed to be a key partner in this project. Funds that are being contributed by the donor will be made to INHS, and those funds will be used to support the design, the placement, the ownership, including the maintenance of statues on property that's owned by INHS. They'll be on two locations, and these locations have been reviewed by the artist. The first is in front of Breckenridge Place Apartments on Cayuga Streets near the intersection with Seneca. If you can picture it, there's a tiny little pocket park right there with a bench. That would be the location for the first of the two statues. The second statue, and these ideally will go concurrently with each other. It's believed that the best location for that would be at the corner of Clinton and Geneva Street. It's where the INHS headquarters is located. The Henry St. John's building is right there on the corner, but in the grassy area right there at the intersection would be the site of statue number two. With respect to subjects, the first one has been identified. This came out of the Historical Commission that has really become something of a fan club for Frances Perkins, that the more is known about Frances Perkins, the more admirable and important she is. You may know that she was the architect of FDR's social welfare programs. Her accomplishments are unbelievable in terms of her being a first, the first industrial commissioner in the state, the first female cabinet secretary. She was in all of FDR's terms. She designed much of the social legislation that Tompkins and other counties currently administer. She was very much an architect of the social safety net. She also spent the last years of her life at Cornell, where she taught at the ILR school. She lived at Telluride House, and she attended St. John's Episcopal Church, which you know is right down the street from Breckenridge. And so it seems fitting that statue of Frances Perkins would go there. The second statue doesn't have a subject, it has a goal. And the goal is to honor persons or families or themes drawn from and identified by the local community of color. Someone who's made an impact on the community, whose story will elevate recognition of others who are too often marginalized. And so the timing is virtually immediate. The sculptor is ready to begin. The design and the placement of the statues we expect will take 2 to 3 years. There are only a few more steps between where we are now and implementation. There is an effort to seek additional funding for education and promotion. The statues themselves and all that goes with it should be covered by the individual contribution of our donor, and this would be supplemental funding for education and promotion. So there will be some doors knocked on to see if additional funds can be raised. There's also a sense that if others contribute to the project, it would be a broader demonstration of community collaboration on what we think is an important project. In terms of community outreach, and this goes back to statue number 2, we are looking for suggestions from the community of color about potential subjects or themes for that second statue, and guidance about how to best engage the community in that conversation. We've started to have conversations with the community's leaders of color. We've had one meeting so far. We hope to have another one soon. And then to engage the community and the artist in an interaction about the subject of statue number 2. The plan is being formalized. Right now, there is work underway to formalize the agreement between the artist and INHS, kind of the business plan to make this happen. The informal steering committee of the historical commission is being formalized so that we have some standing and can serve as an advisor and a consultant to this project as it goes forward. And so that's where we are with what we think is a really fantastic opportunity for the community, something that will bring great public art to us, and give us a chance to honor people who, again, otherwise have not received the recognition that they are due. So.
Thank you, Joe.
Questions? We're here to answer.
Certainly echo those last comments from you. Questions? I see Shauna.
Yeah, thank you for the presentation. Boy, what a generous donor. And this is really an amazing project. I would absolutely love to have one of these sculptures in front of our county center of government building, just to put in a little plug if we so happen to receive more funding. But you know, just to throw this out there, this is really an amazing project, and thank you both for your work on this. I look forward to seeing what ends up coming up from the suggestions and the discussion.
Thank you.
Thank you, Shauna. Rich.
At the risk of being redundant, this is really wonderful news. It's very exciting. And if there comes a point that we could be of assistance in this project, please ask.
Great.
Thank you. That's great.
Good. Thank you, Rich. Anyone else? I can't see if hands are up on the screen. Thank you. All right. I don't see anyone else. Carol and Joe, thank you very much for sharing. It's a fun committee to work with you. This is fun work. I love history. I love this stuff. So I'm glad to be involved. Is there anything else from you? Sean, is your hand still up? Or okay.
Thank you for letting us come tonight. We really appreciate it. We'll keep you posted.
All right. Thank you. Okay. What time is it? I can't tell. Almost 7 o'clock. Let's move on with our agenda. We'll take a break at around 7:30. Is that okay?
Mm-hmm.
All right. So reports from County Administrator, County Attorney, and Director of Finance. Did I miss anybody?
Good evening, everyone.
Did they all go away? Oh, no, Lisa's there. Good evening, Lisa. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and everyone. For the county administration report tonight, I'm just going to go right into the COVID update, and I would like to defer to Amy and Frank to lead us through tonight's COVID update.
Thank you.
All right. Let me just share my screen and we'll get started. All right. Can everyone see the slideshow okay?
Yes, ma'am.
All right. Well, we'll get started then. It's going to look very similar to how we have been doing this for many, many weeks now. Since the last time we met, we have seen a plateau in cases and vaccinations have been continuing. So at this point, we've had an additional 508 cases since we last met. Currently, there are 8 hospitalized, and we've had, unfortunately, 3 additional deaths that have been announced since our last meeting. It's been busy working in the COVID realm, and I'm sure Frank will talk more about that. But some of the major things that has also occurred is schools, pre-K through 12 schools are now open, and we've been working with the staff, talking about guidance for that, talking about testing, vaccination, contact tracing, all of those things, and releasing a lot of information there. We've also been pushing out some more vaccination clinics. They're being held throughout the county. They are much smaller clinics in many cases, but we're continuing to offer it. The pharmacies as well are offering the vaccine. So as people are deciding that they would like to get the vaccine, there's still places that they can do that. We've had some messaging go out around flu clinics and, you know, how the flu vaccine is also vital during the COVID-19 pandemic. Information on, unfortunately, those deaths of some Tompkins County residents, announcing that, as well as sending our condolences to their families and friends. Guidance around the New York State HERO Act, which was announced for our business community, and then some more guidance about contact tracing and how that's approached. The other piece to some of this as well is our mandatory vaccination program or surveillance testing or and surveillance testing that will be launched beginning in October. The first collection date will be October 5th, that Tuesday. We're bringing on additional staff to help with that program. Frank and I spent some time, over an hour and a half, I believe, talking with some of our staff, answering all and any questions that they brought forward, and we're continuing to work on rolling out that program here for our county employees. Our communications continue to remind the community of the precautions that they need to be taking to stop the spread of COVID-19. Again, that mask advisory continues to be in effect. We are encouraging everyone to wear a mask while indoors and around others, regardless of the vaccination status, so we have continued to do that. We have also continued to acknowledge that there's vaccines readily available when people decide that they are ready to get that vaccine. They should be doing that. And also in this time of year, often people, you know, have symptoms that they may not know what's going on. If you are symptomatic and it looks like a COVID symptom, please feel free to get tested. If you're a close contact of a positive case, get tested. And testing continues to be available. This is what our work has looked like, continuing to have overtime hours as well as regular hours associated with the COVID pandemic, continuing to have a lot of staff working on this, especially at the health department. We've brought on additional staff to support the health department, but with high case numbers, that has continued to be a need. Here are the numbers related to the FFCRA leave. Continuing to see some employees taking those benefits. And then some of the COVID-related expenses, you'll see that there's been an additional $313,000 since our last meeting. That includes another bill for our KIGA medical COVID testing and then the contract staffing that we just talked about with the nursing. And at this point, I'm going to turn it over to Frank.
Thanks, Amy. You can go. Oh. One more. Thank you. What are you doing, Amy?
We're going to stop there. Is this the right slide, Frank?
Yeah, that's the right one. Thank you.
Okay.
As Amy alluded to, we did put out guidance for our PK through 12 schools on contact tracing. And we had been talking with the school districts over the summer in preparation for the return of students. Our goal is to follow state and federal guidance, and its intention is to keep kids in school in person as much as possible. So there are very specific guidance for the classroom setting, which virtually eliminates most people in the room as a contact. So for children, as long as they are masked effectively, they are not considered a contact unless they are within 3 feet of the individual, the case, for more than 15 minutes. So for most classrooms, with the way our schools have set up for this school year, we're seeing minimal close contacts to school-based cases. School buses are a bit more challenging. The same guidance doesn't apply to school buses. It's limited to the classroom setting. But we have been working with the districts to identify those that are close contacts, meaning within 6 feet, masked or not, for more than 15 minutes. So far we've done a pretty good job of limiting the number of people needing to be quarantined related to school buses. So this guidance is out. All the superintendents and their staff have it, and it's also located on our website for anyone that wants to take a look at it. Next slide, Amy. This is our standard prevalence slide. As you can see, I think everyone knows by now, our case numbers have dipped off pretty dramatically from the high of just under 500 active cases. And we are kind of settling into a time of between 30 and 50 cases a day, which is more than we had been seeing previously, and is obviously creating a good deal of work for the staff at the health department doing contact tracing and case investigations. As Amy said, we've brought on more staff, both project assistants and per diem nurses, to help. Quite frankly, it's still not enough, so we're still looking for more help, and if there are people out there interested, they can apply for consideration, and we'd be happy to take a look at their applications. But this is kind of where we are now. The cases they're still the most predominant way of catching COVID in Tompkins County is through a household contact. That is the most common way we're seeing, you know, when there's a case in a house, we're seeing more and more people in that same household testing positive. And that's been consistent throughout the pandemic. Beyond that, there really isn't there isn't anything to draw people's attention to. There's a lot of different places of transmission that we've seen. And there's also a lot of instances where we're unable to determine where the person came into contact. So really the general guidance of wearing a mask when you're indoors is whether you're vaccinated or not is really what we're trying to get folks to focus on, and will hopefully provide us the most protection. Next slide, Amy. Of course, getting vaccinated is the primary way to help folks be protected. Our positive cases by vaccination status, you can see our overall numbers are coming down. For a while there, a significant portion of the cases were fully vaccinated, and that was in large part to the student higher ed population. It started to come down a little bit. I think we're just under 50% now. Of fully vaccinated in our cases that we're seeing each week. Vaccination progress continues to tick up. We had a little bit of a tick up in the last couple of weeks, and I think we don't really know exactly why, but I think we can attribute it to deadlines related to higher education. Both Cornell, Ithaca College, and TC3 had students getting vaccinated as they returned to their academic work in preparation of compliance with those mandates on campus. So that's likely why we saw, you know, a big jump, not a big jump, but a jump that you can see in the last couple of weeks. I think that's all we have for tonight. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you all. Frank, I was going to attribute the vaccine pickup for my birthday and Amy's, as we ask people to do that for us.
I'm sure that burst,
you just had to burst our bubbles, didn't you? Questions? Comments? Mike Lane, Mike Sigler?
Thanks to both of you for report as we have each time. Frank, last year, I know your department put out a push for flu shots. Are we going to be doing that again? It's flu shot time.
Yeah, we've already had a press release go out. We are looking at some ad buys to get word about flu shots. I've been doing media around flu shots the last few days. I have a couple of more this week. So, yeah, we're definitely working to get the word out about flu shots.
Thanks.
Thank you. Mike Sigler?
I just had two questions. I had two questions, Frank. I was just wondering, how effective the clinics that we're still holding? I mean, do we get people going to those? Or, I mean, how effective are they at this point?
Yeah, so we're actually winding down the clinics that we're doing. We're finishing up at TC3 this week with second dose clinics. The TC3 ones were pretty successful because the students had a mandate. The other ones that we were doing out in some of the rural parts of the county, as they were requested, not as popular. You know, we'd get 10 here. I think we did 25 or 30 at one of them, which was, we were really happy to see the turnout there. But yeah, the numbers have really slowed down. And, you know, our message now is vaccine is readily available, whether with your healthcare provider or at your local pharmacy. And that's where we would encourage folks to go. We're really prepping now for boosters and the approach that will be needed to meet that demand.
That leads me to my next question is, so I get a flu shot every year. If there was some type of pairing of flu shot with your booster, I would go for that. So I'm wondering, are we going to do any kind of effort in the marketing of flu shots to say, hey, when you come in and get your flu shot, you should get your COVID shot? Or do we kind of assume that those kind of people already do that? Maybe they do.
Yeah, hopefully we're not assuming anything because, you know, we just don't know how folks are going to react. But I think in the pharmacy setting, you will see that. And you all probably are aware that pre-COVID, the health department was really getting out of the flu vaccine business because it was so readily available in our community. The clinics that we were holding really were to maintain skills of our nurses in case we needed them for what we just went through. So, yes, that is the messaging that we do want to give those vaccines together. We're working with the hospital on our booster dose approach. No final decisions have been made on whether we'll be able to co-locate flu at the same place, but certainly we're considering it and recognize it's an opportunity.
All right. Thanks, Frank.
Thank you. Deborah Henry, Martha.
Yeah, thank you, Leslin, and thank you, Frank. You know, as an old person who got the Pfizer shot, which I'm now starting to read loses its effectiveness considerably after 4 months, I'm looking to get my booster shot when at the appropriate time. Is that going to be offered through the pharmacies now and the your general practitioner or your healthcare provider?
Yeah, so vaccine is widely available. We don't have a shortage or a limited amount as we did when we did this the first time. So it is easier for the private sector to help us administer the vaccine. Rationing is not really, you know, in their business model. So this will be a little bit different, and we will be encouraging people to go to their healthcare provider or their local pharmacist. But we are working with the hospital to put on a smaller scale a mass vaccine location at the mall again for those that want to use that as their opportunity. I would point out it has not been approved yet beyond that third dose. There's multiple processes. The FDA's advisory committee did make a recommendation for 65 plus and those at high risk. The CDC's advisory group will meet this week, I believe. They'll make a recommendation, and then it will be both the CDC and the FDA needing to give approvals. And then, of course, in New York has to give approval to it as well. So we're still waiting for those processes to unfold. We are hopeful that we're only talking about a matter of weeks, though, before those approvals would be granted.
So if I could take a follow-up, what would be the appropriate time? Would it be the 6 months?
Well, we'll be told that. Told that by the folks that review the data related to these vaccines. It does look like 6 months is what came out of the FDA. ACIP will review it as well, and they will give us the details. And ultimately, the FDA has to give authorization, and in that authorization, we'll identify who is eligible.
Thank you.
All right, Henry, and then Martha.
Yes, thank you, Frank. I know that in New York State, there's an issue about the healthcare workers getting vaccinated. Do you know whether that's an issue in Tompkins County?
I think we were already at risk for a shortage of healthcare workers pre-pandemic, and it's only gotten worse due to burnout and other issues, you know, over the last year or so. Obviously, we're hearing the same anecdotes as everyone about the potential for losing healthcare workers related to the mandate. You'd have to ask the hospital directly what their thinking is around that. I don't know, and I'd hate to hazard a guess. I know we're a week away from knowing for sure whether or not folks are going to walk away from their employment because of the mandate. It will be challenging if that happens because we were already struggling before that.
That also cover nursing home workers too?
Yes, I believe so. It's all healthcare workers.
Thank you.
All right, Martha and then Annie.
Thank you, Leslie. Thank you, Amy and Frank. I'm hearing reports that young people ages, 12 to 16, there's not we haven't gotten a great acceptance. The percentage of vaccinations for those young people is not that great. Do you know what our local rates are? Are we seeing that here as well?
Yeah, I don't know off the top of my head, Martha. I'm sorry. We can check into that. Last that I saw, our uptake rate was pretty consistent with the broader population. But let me double check on that and get back to you.
Thank you. Because I sort of think at this point, at least some people might be kind of amenable to a vaccine if they literally don't have to go out of their way at all, like if there's a clinic at their workplace or if they're at their school. So a matter of convenience and almost an impulse buy, So I wonder if we could take a look at that too. And, cause I know we're inching up, 74,000, et cetera, but we'd really love to catch more. What about on the flu shot together with COVID shots? Is there any concern that side effects might be amplified or effectiveness might actually be diminished if you're putting two together at the same time?
Yeah, there's no evidence right now, and the recommendation is that you can do them simultaneously. The risk of not having one over the other, again, outweighs any risk of associated side effects.
Okay, got it. All right, thank you very much. And thanks for looking into the young people, especially as we may have approval for younger kids soon. It would be really great. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Annie.
Thank you. So the question that I have is concerning the three people who have recently passed away who were fully vaccinated. And it was stated that they were elderly. And so I'm just wondering, I've had people ask me from the community, do we have any other information that we can share? Were they, for instance, were they living in a nursing home or another institutional residential setting? Do we have anything further about the actual age or closer, or anything else that we could share about them?
No. The information that we shared is what we felt we were comfortable sharing. We actually ran into an issue with the first press release we put out because we added a little bit more information that we normally do, and it created some significant angst for the affected family. And so I think what we've thought all along is that we have to be very, very careful about how much information we're providing when it can be potentially identifiable. So at this point, we don't have any more information to release about those individuals.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Thank you all very much. Thank you for your continued hard work on this, and everyone in here and on the screen as well, as we can need to push people to get vaccinated and to mask up, keep sending the message. All right. Anything else from you, Amy, Frank, Dominic, Lisa? All right. Anything from the county attorney?
I'm going with no report.
All right. Anything from finance director? And I see the deputy director of finance, Drew. Anything from you?
We also share no report.
Thank you. I take it you said no report.
I did say no report. Sorry.
Thank you. Thank you, Drew. Oh, Rich?
I did have a question for Drew, if I might.
Sorry, Drew, yes. You don't get away that easy. There's a question for you, which might generate about another 10 questions, just so you know.
Sorry. I just had a question about, we were given a page to insert in our budget books on the status of general fund balance. And I was wondering, the ARPA funds that we took into the county, what account did they go into?
Those have actually
going into fund balance, but they don't seem to show up here.
They don't. They actually have set up as a liability on our balance sheet. So they don't go to fund balance because we haven't allocated them and actually earned them. So while we received them, if we didn't expend them on approved projects, we would have to return them.
Okay. But in effect, they are fund balance.
Well, because they are not yet earned, they can't be credited to our fund balance. They are in the checking account, yes, but okay. They truly, the fund balance is usually a net result of revenues less what expenditures we have.
Yeah. Given that we have a pretty high degree of confidence that we will spend that money, it's not going to stay a liability, I assume.
No, it will not. And actually, we're following what's prescribed by the state office of controller, and they wanted us set up as a liability after we receive the funds. And then as you do the approved projects, you move it from that. And I think there's been already a couple budget amendments that move it from that liability to the revenue in that department, and then the offsetting expenditures in that department.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, Drew. Thank you, Rich, for your question. Okay. Moving on in our agenda. Is there any staff waiting for any resolutions on the agenda? Anybody else waiting for anything? I see Derek. So that's one of the consent agenda, so we'll take consent agenda up. All right, any other resolutions to be added or withdrawn from the agenda? All right, so let's move on to the consent agenda, which are resolutions and appointments to be voted on as a group unless any member of the legislature requested a resolution or appointment be instead included separately and individually as part of the business of standing or special committees. And I will go down the titles. Let's start with our advisory board appointments to public safety, from public safety committee, sub the DWI and traffic safety board, day and a half, at large member whose term expires on December 31st, 2023, and to the health, from health and human services committee, to the community mental health services board, substance abuse subcommittee, Sulimar Pena Vasquez, community member whose term expires December 31st, 2022. Resolutions from Facilities and Infrastructure Committee. Resolution A, award of bid PIN 3756.10 Pine Tree Road, County Road 174, Highway Safety Improvement Project, Town of Ithaca, New York, ID 10375, and I'm assuming this is past committee. Resolution B, thank you. Authorization to amend supplemental funding agreement SA number 2, construction with New York State Department of Transportation for PIN 3756.53 Etna Lane Bridge, County Route 109 over Fall Creek, BIN 3314180, Town of Dryden, ID 10376. Public Safety Committee, Resolution C, abolishing the Tompkins County Family Court Advisory Council, ID 10215. Resolution D.
Please pull that.
Pull off the consent agenda. From Health and Human Services Committee. Resolution E. Extend the contracts with Cayuga Health Systems, COVID-19 testing, ID 10366. Resolution F, budget adjustments, long-term care ombudsman program, WIN, Title 3C1, Tompkins County Office for the Aging, ID 10383. And from Budget, Capital, and Personnel Committee, Resolution G, scheduling a public hearing on the 2022 Tompkins County budget and the 2022-2026 Tompkins County Capital Program, ID 10354. May I have someone move the consent agenda, please? Moved by Glenn Morey, seconded by Amanda Champion. Let's have a vote on the consent agenda.
Dan Klein?
Yes.
Dan Corman?
Yes.
Mike Lane?
Yes.
Dave McKenna?
Yes.
Glenn Morey?
Yes.
Martha Robertson?
Yes.
Leslie Schill?
Yes.
Mike Sigler?
Yes.
Shauna Black?
Yes.
Amanda Champion?
Yes.
Deborah Dawson?
Yes. Sorry.
Henry Granison?
Yes.
Rich John?
Yes.
Leslie McLean Claiborne?
Yes.
14 ayes, 0 noes.
Thank you. That carries unanimously. Let's go to Public Safety Committee. We have Resolution D, I believe, that was pulled off of the consent agenda. Rich John, Chair of Public Safety.
Sorry. Thank you. I would move Resolution D, authorization to accept Triad Foundation donation and budget adjustment, Sheriff's Office.
I have a second, please. Seconded by Deborah Dawson. Discussion. Martha, you pulled it off of consent agenda.
Yes, thank you very much. Sheriff Osborne, good to see you there.
I was just hoping to get a little more discussion, explanation of the equipment that would be bought with this grant. And in particular, the resolution mentions crime prevention services and public relations outreach. I'm not sure how those are explained in the memo. If you could help me understand what's included here and what the purposes are.
Yeah, I don't understand what public outreach would be involved in that myself, so I apologize for that. But yeah, the shields are for the purchase of four shields that'll go on our supervisors' vehicles. They are for defensive purposes only. They prevent being hit by gunfire. And if you recall, maybe a year or so ago, we talked about opportunities to lessen our dependence on the SWAT team. And there are opportunities where we show up and there are weapons involved that will provide us an opportunity to secure the perimeter and help our deputies stay safe, either allowing us an opportunity to resolve the situation without a SWAT team or to protect them while they are waiting for the SWAT team or the CERT team, I should say. No, again, I'm sorry. The BOLO wrap is we're looking to purchase two of them. They will also be in our supervisor vehicles. They won't be for general purpose by the use by the deputies because we won't have enough of them, but they are a less lethal device that are pretty low on the use of force spectrum. And that'll give us an opportunity to restrain somebody if we need to without using elevated levels of force. It actually is a very good thing. It shoots out a Kevlar rope that wraps around the legs and stops somebody from fighting, running. And it will be used for incidences, perhaps when somebody has a mental illness that we're trying to interact with, things of that nature. It's an up-and-coming tool that's pretty gaining rapid use by law enforcement. That's the general rundown on those two things.
Okay, I appreciate that. You know, I think it's important, especially the community is certainly watching what we're doing with reimagining public safety, and I think it's important to be sensitive to what's in writing and what's in our budget, what we approve. So whether it's tax dollars or a grant, I think it's important that we're really aware of what we're buying. So thanks very much for the explanation, Derek. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Sheriff Osborne. Other questions? Rich, you had your hand up.
I was just going to say I support the resolution to accept the grant money. I think this is a good use of funds to look at adding more tools to the toolbox, so that there's more flexibility of response and certainly more flexibility of less lethal force. So I will vote yes.
All right, let's take this to a vote. And then
Dan Pine?
Yes.
Ann Corman?
Yes.
Mike Lane?
Yes.
Dave McKenna?
Yes.
Glenn Morey?
Yes.
Martha Robertson?
Yes.
Leslie Shill?
Yes.
Mike Sigler?
Yes.
Black?
Yes.
Amanda Champion?
Yes.
Deborah Dawson?
Yes.
Henry Granison?
Yes.
Rich John?
Yes.
Leslin McBean-Claiborne?
Yes.
14 ayes, 0 noes.
That carries unanimously. Rich, will you continue with your report on the next resolution?
Sure. I would move Resolution C, abolishing the Tompkins County Family Court Advisory Council.
Is what you have next. Resolution already passed on this agenda.
Oh, you're right. Sorry. I would move Resolution J, budget adjustment and appropriation of unspent funds from 2020 and prior years to various accounts of the departments that report to the Public Safety Committee.
I have a second, please. Seconded by Glenn Morey. Discussion. All right. Votes.
Dan Klein?
Yes.
Ann Corman?
Yes.
Mike Lane?
Yes.
Dave McKenna?
Yes.
Glenn Morey?
Yes.
Martha Robertson?
Yes.
Leslie Shill?
Yes.
Mike Sigler?
Yes.
Black?
Yes.
Amanda Champion?
Yes.
Deborah Dawson?
Yes.
Henry Granison?
Yes.
Rich John?
Yes.
Leslie Matheny-Claiborne?
Yes.
14 ayes, 0 noes.
That carries unanimously. Other report from your committee, Rich?
Yes, the Public Safety Committee met last Thursday, September 16th, and I do have a few items of news to report to the legislature. One, we had a report from URO and OAR, that's Ultimate Reentry Opportunities, and OAR is Opportunities,
Alternatives
and Resources, I believe. I always have it by their old acronym. I apologize. Where they presented on a proposal in collaboration with INHS, Ithaca Neighborhood Housing Services, to develop a 20-unit supported facility for people coming out of jail and prison, particularly people on parole. This has been a real issue for us in terms of controlling our jail population because the parole system is not controlled locally, and they have not taken advantage of our alternatives to incarceration programming. Housing being probably the leading indicator of recidivism. Pardon me, I'm fogging up here. Housing is so critical to being able to establish, permanence in the community and to hold a job, to be able to, get services that are needed to reenter the community. So this was a really good presentation. It does look like they've got a well thought out plan, and we'll see more from them. So they presented to us. I also wanted to let the legislature know two other things. One is a representative of New York State came and visited with us last week and presented on a centralized arraignment program that we are now allowed to set up in Tompkins County. And while it might seem a little bit inside baseball, the pandemic has really presented a test case for having arraignments done in a different way than they had been done before. Usually, or in the past, they've been done at all the individual courts all over the county by individual judges. And because of the pandemic and the need to maintain distance and do things in a less contact-intensive way, we went to a system where there were online arraignments and arraignments done by judges collectively in lots of different cases at centralized places. It's really worked. It's far better in terms of maximizing the judge's time or optimizing the judge's time. But even more importantly, individuals get presented in a regular way. You put the police officers back on the road. You're using less time from the district attorney and the defense attorneys, particularly assigned counsel who handle about 85% of our criminal defense. So it's a far more efficient system. We were not legally allowed to do it in the past, but it does appear we're going to be able to go forward with that now. The other news I have is that law enforcement assisted diversion is about to launch in the city of Ithaca. This has been a very long time in development, and it was interrupted by the pandemic. Travis Brooks from the city has been working on this, who will join us, I believe, in a bit or May as a result of the election here. And this is a really exciting bit of news. We anticipate that if it's successful, that it may be expanded more broadly in the county, but it is a way to try to deal with very low-level crimes in a different way than arrest. Rather than arresting the person, we divert to services and provide sort of wraparound care to try to get people into programming and to help them rather than just arrest them. So that's my report. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Rich. Questions before we take a break? Martha?
Thanks, Rich. Great report. In the past, centralized arraignment has been opposed by defense attorneys. They wanted their clients to have the opportunity to actually be in person and see the judge, the justice. Is that not an issue now that COVID wiped that away?
No, it certainly is an issue. And Lance Salisbury, you know, has attended the meetings. And in fact, he came to the Public Safety Committee last week. We had a good discussion about it. The advantage of centralized arraignment is it's much easier on the counsel and that it's entirely predictable. You also will have, if the city joins in with all the town and village courts, a regular cycle where you'll have arraignments probably in the morning, say between 8 and 9 o'clock starting, and the same thing in the evening, so that there's a regular time period for it rather than calling people out at 3 or 4 in the morning, which having done assigned counsel early in my career and attended arraignments at all hours of the night, I can tell you it wasn't always my best time. And, you know, you want everybody there in a objective, you know, calm environment. And centralized arraignment probably will do a much better job of accomplishing that. We do recognize that centralized arraignment may lead to some potential defendants being held for a period of time until the arraignment. And with bail reform occurring in the past year and a half, that is a concern. And we certainly want to design the system that people are not detained any longer than they need to be, particularly on charges where they will not be, you know, for the charge, they would not be subject to bail.
All right, thank you. And I just want to say, in case people didn't notice, the governor has signed the Less is More Act. I'm not sure how quickly that takes effect, but the whole issue that you were pushing a number of months ago, that the legislature did pass it and she signed it so that technical violations won't be a reason people are sent back to incarceration. So
Thank you for mentioning that, Martha, because yes, that was a pretty big development from the state just this past few days. New York State has moved forward on bail reform, on discovery reform, and parole was really out there waiting for some attention. And I think the Less is More Act will give us a good opportunity to see if we can do better than it has been running. You know, the average has been 65% of the people who go out on parole were going back into the prison system, which really is defeating the objective of parole. So hopefully this will lead to some better statistics and impacts on people's lives.
It starts on March of 22.
I'm sorry, Henry, what are you yelling out? I didn't hear it.
It starts March of 22.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for letting us know. All right, is there anything else?
Actually, Leslie, with the my colleague's indulgence, I would like to just speak for a moment to the person who came to Privilege of the Floor and was talking about overdoses. And asking for information on overdoses. I did want to make clear, we spend a fair amount of time trying to understand that issue, that we gather information from a lot of different resources to figure out what is going on in our community. And it's certainly been a time of heightened attention because nationally, overdoses have spiked in the pandemic. And this has been a real problem across our country. We don't seem to have seen that same rise here in Tompkins County. And I think there's a variety of reasons for it. It could be that we're not seeing it. We certainly track 911 calls for overdose or poisoning, and we haven't seen significant change in those numbers. We also try to get some sense of use of Narcan, the medicine used to counteract an overdose. But it's very hard to track because lots and lots of people are trained to use Narcan. And some people overdose and they don't get Narcan and they recover and you can't get any statistics there. It's also complicated in that for those who get medical treatment, that's confidential. And so it's very difficult to get real reporting out of people getting medical treatment as a result of an overdose, and appropriately so. And then also you have the issue that a lot of the drugs people overdose on are illegal, and they don't want anybody to know that they overdose. And they certainly don't want to provide samples of the drugs they overdosed on for testing. So it's hard. It's not that, you know, we wouldn't like to know, and that we're not spending a lot of time and effort, both on the county level, but on local agencies. I'd point to Southern Tier AIDS Prevention, who does a lot of work with needle exchange and trying to assist people who are struggling with addiction, and Reach Medical, and as well as the Drug and Alcohol Council and CARS. There's a lot of people in our community thinking about this issue and trying to do something about it. So I just didn't want to leave that unaddressed because it is a significant problem. The speaker is correct that we should be paying attention to it, and we're trying. Thank you.
Thank you, Rich. I appreciate you responding and want to acknowledge that it's not new that we're paying attention. We have been. And the state, even the state, had changed the way that it collects the information so that we can get some better reporting on what counts as overdose. So thank you very much. On that note, Rich, we're going to take a quick break, 10-minute, well, more like 9.5 minutes break. Please be back here at 10 of so that we can power through the rest of our agenda. We're back in session, and we are going to continue. We have quorum. We're going to continue with our standing committee agenda. Facilities and Infrastructure Committee, Mike Lane, Chair.
Thank you. We met on September 16th. We had a very interesting presentation out of our facilities department. Aurel Lamaro and Alan Lockett, along with Perry Carroll, our Chief Sustainability Officer, brought in several folks from Johnson Controls. And the presentation was about our green facilities project, which folks ought to know is to make our county buildings carbon, reduce carbon to zero by 2035. And we are looking at a bond resolution that was passed at that meeting, which will be coming forward to this legislature, I think next meeting, which will fund up to $6 million toward those projects over the period of time which the project will be moving forward. It was kind of interesting. One of the questions I put to the people from Johnson Controls, which is a consultant who has worked for us for a long time and works for many municipalities, I said, gauging us compared to other municipalities you work for, where would you put us in the efforts for our green initiatives? I said, would we be behind some of them? Are we equal to some of them? Are we ahead of some of them? And interestingly enough, we had reply was, we're way ahead of everybody. In fact, as they said, you're ahead of us. We're only beginning right now to have a part of our Johnson Controls industry, or business, I should say, which will be focused on these kinds of green initiatives. So I think that's a
a good thing for Tompkins County. We passed a second bond resolution that will be coming to the legislature, and that is for $4,900,000 in to borrowing for the backup dispatch center, which will be the facility which will make our emergency communications. We'll have a second location so that it will be redundant if we lose our primary dispatch center's ability to communicate. We talked a little bit more about the proposed resolution that will govern our how we go forward with the Bridge New York funding for the municipalities that, that may be applying and getting Bridge New York funds. Jeff Smith, our highway director, feels very strongly that that should be a basically, he should have a lot of leeway to negotiate with the individual municipalities about what kind of bridge, what kind of betterments that might be, and what percentage of the cost will be borne by the county versus the municipalities, along with the original 5% and up to 20% more, so that it recognizes the savings to the Tompkins County. That was a thorough discussion about that. A couple of us thought it ought to be more specific, but that did not carry the day. We will continue discussion on that, and hopefully we'll bring that to a resolution next time. I reported as the rep to the ITCTC, Ithaca Tompkins County Transportation Council, just a couple of things. One is the Route 34 project in Lansing. State DOT people told us last week that delivery of the steel is still 2 months away. So there's really no way that that bridge is going to get opened until warmer weather, when after the steel is set, they can pour the concrete for the roadway. So unfortunately, that's gone into going into the next season. Also, Mark Frechette, who has been our contact with DOT for many years, is no longer going to be doing that. His deputy will be, but Mark is going to has moved up. He's been put in charge of the public relations and oversight and communications for the whole City of Syracuse I-81 project. That's a $2 billion project, and I guess we're small change compared to that. But he's a good guy, and we wish him well. Dave, did we miss anything? Dan?
Yeah, it was. I'm not sure whether it's F&I or the ITCTC. I can't remember. They announced something that I was really excited about. I just wanted to share it, that the extension of the East Ithaca Recreation Way, the trail, is set to be possibly even next month. It's going to continue from Game Farm Road all the way on to Route 13. So that's a very exciting development to me. I just wanted to share it. Thanks.
Absolutely. Thanks, Dan, for mentioning that.
Thank you. Any questions to Mike on his report?
I've got one other resolution.
Yeah, I was just checking to see if there are any report questions.
Go ahead with your resolution.
This is Resolution H, authorizing award of bid, rehabilitate taxiway A, Phase 3, general aviation apron and taxiway D construction, the Ithaca Tompkins International Airport. That's ID 10372, and I so move.
May I have a second, please? Glenn Morey. Any discussion on the resolution? Okay, let's vote on it.
Dan Klein?
Yes.
Ann Corman?
Yes.
Mike Lane?
Yes.
Dave McKenna?
Yes.
Glenn Morey?
Yes.
Martha Robertson?
Yes.
Leslie Schill?
Yes.
Mike Ziegler?
Yes.
Shauna Black?
Yes.
Amanda Champion?
Yes.
Deborah Dawson?
Yes.
Attorney Granison? Henry Granison?
Yes.
Rick Shunt?
Yes.
Wilson McLean Claiborne?
Yes.
14 ayes, 0 noes.
Thank you. That carries. Anything else from you, Mike?
No, thanks.
All right. Tom Hintz, Intergovernmental Relations Committee, Martha Robertson, Chair.
Thank you very much, Leslyn. We met this morning, so it's fresh in my mind. We had a lot of material to go over. Lisa updated us on some of her conversations about the Bell Station sale, Bell Station land, and the NYSEG property, the NYSEG auction, and continued conversations. Assemblywoman Anna Kellis joined us a little early, and so we continued with kind of what the strategy is and what the law is. A couple of just quick takeaways is that we really probably want to try to help to publicize the controversy with the slightly devious idea that that might depress developers' thirst for bidding on this property, and Deborah agreed to take a first stab at an op-ed. The signatures for the petition that has been going around, important to keep that going. There are about 4,200 signatures at the moment, and Anna felt that 5,000 would be a great threshold. We're also going to pull together a meeting with the town of Lansing about their plans that might help in this area. We then also talked about Camp Barton and Camp Comstock. Apparently the Finger Lakes Land Trust is active on this property as well, and we thought we would let them take the lead on it for starters. Camp Barton is actually not in Tompkins County, but as somebody said, there aren't any borders on the lake. So stay tuned. I wasn't able to find a report on whether they voted last night. Their board was supposed to vote last night, and we weren't able to find out yet what that result was. Diane Miller from Cornell in Washington gave us an exhausting, recitation of all the things that are going on in Washington, like the next 2 weeks. It's crazy. She called it peak posturing time. So we'll be very interested to see how some of these enormously critical issues come together or fall apart in the next couple of weeks. We also talked at length about redistricting and looked at the maps that Henry was able to find online to really compare. If people haven't kept up on this, on September 15th, the Independent Redistricting Commission issued two sets of maps, a Republican set of maps and a Democratic set of maps for the Senate, State Senate, Assembly, and Congress. And kind of we looked at those six maps and talked about sort of the pluses and minuses for Tompkins County. It's really important for us to public comment in the next few months is going to be extremely important to see if there's any adjustment that can be made. And, we're going to work on that further and try to come up at our August meeting, come up with a proposal of what we would recommend, what our public comment would be as a county, and bring something forward so that we can put that into the public record. And then finally, I just want to mention that Anna gave us a mini course on cryptocurrency, and there will be a quiz later on what proof of stake is versus proof of work. And, I'm laughing, but it's really important in terms of the energy, I'll say wasted on crypto mining, and she's working really hard on a bill for a three-year moratorium while the environmental impacts of crypto mining are evaluated by the DEC. So she's got legislation that would that we feel deserves our support, and we will work on bringing a resolution forth on that as well. So that's kind of the quick story. Our next meeting is October 12th at 10:30. And as I said, we'll try to really bring something together out of that meeting on redistricting at the very least. So committee members, if I left out anything important, please jump in. So.
Thank you, Martha. Any questions for Martha? Tiger.
Nope. All right. Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Government Operations Committee, Amanda Trempion, Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Government Operations met earlier this afternoon before this meeting very briefly to pass the resolution that we voted on earlier tonight, appointing our new Board of Elections Commissioner. We are meeting next on October 7th, which is the first Thursday in October at noon. But I just wanted to tell you all two things, which I believe I've sent you emails on as well. I'm happy to report that the Tompkins County Public Library Board has appointed an interim director. That will be Teresa Vatican, who is currently the head of adult services at the library. And she is wonderful, and I think it's a great step while the board reassesses their search plan and thinks about the civil service process again, and they'll start another search for a new director, I think, in the spring. And then our local redistricting process, we ended up with 17 applications for our local commission. And the next step is that the Government Operations Committee, which is the group that will be doing the interviews and putting forth a recommendation for the 9 commissioners who will be on that commission, we're going to start looking at those applications and setting up interview times with those folks. And we will keep you updated on how that goes. And that's all.
Thank you. That's awesome. 17 applications. Beautiful. A little bit of push. Anything for Amanda? Okay. Moving on. Planning, Energy, and Environmental Quality Committee, Anna Corman, Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We met on August 23rd, and I reported on that at the last committee meeting, but our next committee meeting is coming up next Monday, September 27th at 1:30 p.m. And what we have on our agenda, it's we have the proposed adoption of the Tompkins County Hazard Mitigation Plan, and that's the update for 2021. And we also have a report and discussion from Sustainable Tompkins. If you're not familiar with them, they do a lot of great environmental things in the community. One quick plug, I'll give something I've used before from their website, is you can calculate your carbon footprint for your business, for travel, for your home, for your vehicle. So that's something I've used before when I'm going on a trip, whether you're taking a car or a plane, you can go in there and offset your carbon use for that, or you can do it on a regular basis. And that money goes towards supporting local jobs. A lot of them have to do with helping make houses locally more energy efficient. And so please join us on September 27th at 1:30. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Ann? All right. Budget, Capital, and Personnel Committee, Deborah Dawson, Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess let's start with the resolution for the breathlessly awaited administrative policy on fund balance. That would be Resolution I, Resolution to Update the Administrative Policy Manual, Policy 0504, Fund Balance, ID 10351, and I move that.
May I have a second to that resolution, please? Seconded by Shauna Black.
Okay, well, I guess I can begin to introduce this anyway. This policy did not pass GO, and I think it was likely because there was they only had four people, so it was kind of a tie. So we did go ahead and pass it. This is a policy that would set fund balance ranges or minimums for several different funds, but the one that's of greatest interest to all of us is the general fund balance. And the resolution as it passed budget was that there would be a range of 18 to 23%, which would be the minimum.
Thank you, Deborah. Other discussion? Martha.
I would like to appreciate the detail and the thought that's gone into this policy. I think it's a lot of really good improvements that will guide the legislature in the future. I would like to make one amendment. Packet page 27 under general fund, the assigned, the minimum unassigned fund balance for the general fund, I would like to move that the target, instead of being 18 to 23%, I would like to move that to be 18 to 20%. If I get a second, I'll make some comments on it.
Seconded by Dan Klein.
Discussion? It's actually, Deborah, I think you inadvertently reinforced the reason I would like to change this upper limit. You just said that the unassigned fund balance would be 18 to 23% at a minimum. And that's actually what I'm worried about. We heard a lot of conversation, a lot of education from Rick Snyder about the GFOA standards, the standard being 2 months of operating expenses being a minimum for your fund balance, unassigned fund balance. That's 16.7% as the guidance for what your minimum should be. So 18% seems like, okay, that's a good buffer. In fact, we had a lot of discussion in committee in BCP about should there even be an upper number, since there's nothing in the policy that really says what you should do if you go over that upper number. Maybe we should just have the baseline, the floor, which really is the safety valve. If you have, you want to make sure you have at least 2 months and then some. So the 18% is a really good figure, and the policy goes through what do we do if we're lower than 18%. So appreciate that. That's good. But it seems that having an upper limit there, having a range, there's really no explanation for why 20%. And I worry that when the people will start to see 23%, as the minimum, not 18%, but 23. And that would unfortunately sort of guide and color the decisions that staff and legislature may make in the future and mean that the legislature would lose out on opportunities or really not be prepared to take advantage of opportunities that would come their way. So I think I would prefer just saying an 18%. Floor, but based on the conversation at BCP, I thought perhaps 18 to 20 would get more support and give people comfort that some people seem to want to have a range without being overly prescriptive. So that is the proposal. I did vote against this at BCP because I was not in favor of 18 to 23%, and that's what ended up on as the main motion. So that's kind of the thinking, and I hope
right.
So thank you.
To change minimum unassigned fund balance to a range of 18 to 20 instead of 18 to 23 as was presented. It was seconded by Dan Klein. Discussion on the amendment. Mike Lean and then Deb Dawson.
Yeah, I don't support the amendment. I support the original resolution. This policy has been under consideration for well over a year. Rick Snyder and Jason Molino were the ones that came forward with it. They're the ones that originally and still do support the range of 18 to 23. Anything we set can always be changed by resolution of the legislature. But having sufficient amount in fund balance in case we have emergencies that we may not even know what they're going to be yet is pretty important. And I don't agree with the folks who say that there's no consequences for the upper range. What it does is alert us if we are getting a larger fund balance and alerts us to start taking steps as to perhaps reducing taxes, spending some funds on one-time projects, those kinds of things. I don't think we ought to have a lower amount because I think it's important that we have a good amount in the bank for things that may come along. And we certainly are glad that we had what we did in our fund balance now through the pandemic. So I can't support this.
Mike, Deb Dawson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, at the risk of repeating what I said at BCP, logically it makes no sense to have a range when there is no prescribed consequence of exceeding the range. I appreciate the argument that Mike makes, which is, you know, people need to be alerted as to when maybe we ought to be using fund balance instead of raising taxes. But on the other hand, we've had a 10% fund balance policy now for years, and our current fund balance is now way more than 10%. So I just don't see the logical reason to have a range at all. That said, I think any upper level on the range is totally arbitrary. I don't think 20% any less arbitrary than 23. It's not a hill I want to die on. So, obviously, if y'all think that we need to have a range, even though there's no consequence to the upper end of the range, so be it.
I'll call you later for whatever that phrase is you just used. I can write that one down, too. I got kowtow or whatever that one is down right. Anyone else? Okay, let's hold on the amendment.
Dan Klein?
Yes.
Dan Korman?
No.
Mike Lane?
No.
Dave McKenna?
No.
Glenn Morey?
No.
Martha Robertson?
Yes.
Leslie Shill?
Yeah.
Mike Sigler?
Yes.
Donna Black?
No.
Amanda Champion?
No.
Deborah Dawson?
Yes.
Henry Granison?
Yes.
Rich John?
No.
Leslie Matheen Claiborne?
No. Okay, so we're back. Sorry.
Six ayes, eight noes.
Okay, that amendment fails. So we're back to the main motion, which includes a policy change of minimum unassigned fund balance, a range of 18 to 23%. That's what's on the table. Discussion. Henry?
I want to propose an amendment that we just change it to 18% flat rate.
Amendment to 18%, seconded by Leslie Shill. Discussion?
Yes, Donna Black.
I just have clarification on that, Henry. Are you saying up to 18% or a minimum of 18%? Like, what is the wording with that?
Second?
No. Point of information?
Yes.
Was the proposal to just go to 18%?
Proposal is to just go to 18%.
Okay, thank you.
So instead of what was in there, 10%, and the proposal that came from committee 18 to 23, Henry is making an amendment for 18%. Not up to, not just a minimum unassigned fund balance of 18%.
Yep.
Right. Any other discussion? Okay, let's vote.
Dan Klein?
Yes.
Dan Corman?
Yes.
Mike Lane?
No.
Dave McKenna?
Yes.
Glenn Morey?
No.
Martha Robertson?
Yes.
Leslie Shill?
Yes.
Mike Sigler?
Yes.
Donna Black?
Yes.
Amanda Champion?
No.
Deborah Dawson?
Yes.
Henry Granison?
Yes.
Rich John?
No.
Leslie McBean Claiborne?
No.
9 ayes, 5 noes.
Okay, that carries as the amendment. 9 ayes, 5 noes. It becomes the main motion. Now we have to vote on the main motion, which is the policy, administrative policy changes as presented from committee, including on minimum unassigned fund balance, general fund of 18%. Okay, let's vote.
Dan Klein?
Yes.
Ann Corman?
Yes.
Mike Lane?
No.
Dave McKenna?
Yes.
Glenn Morey?
Yes.
Martha Robertson?
Yes.
Leslie Shield?
Yes.
Mike Sigler?
Yes.
Shauna Black?
Yes.
Amanda Champion?
Yes.
Deborah Dawson?
Yes.
Henry Granison?
Yes.
Rich John?
Yes.
Leslie McBean Claiborne?
No.
With 12 ayes, 2 noes.
That carries. Thank you very much for that. Deborah, rest of your committee report.
Oh, God, just when I put a mouthful of salad in my mouth. Give me a minute. So, this afternoon we met with Bill Talbot at TC3. You'll all be hearing more about it. They have asked that we and Cortland County fund a 50% local match for a $1.5 million application. They want to file with SUNY to get a grant for some fairly urgent infrastructure maintenance and improvements. And I've asked Lisa and Rick and Drew to work with Bill to figure out what exactly it would look like that would satisfy SUNY that they have an actual commitment from us to provide that funding if and when they can actually go forward with the projects. So I will keep you all posted on that.
Thank you. Anything else? Any questions for Deborah? Okay, let's move on. Workforce Diversity and Inclusion Committee, Henry Granison, Chair.
Yes, we have a special meeting tomorrow to consider the diversity statement, which has been edited, and we hope to have the diversity statement passed by the end of the year. So we're going to go to WDIC, then go out to the public or the employees, and then come to the legislature to pass it.
Okay. Thank you, Henry. Any questions for Henry? All right. House and Economic Development Committee, Martha Robertson, Chair.
Thank you, Leslyn. We will meet this Thursday and at 9:30. A variety of typical reports, tourism, broadband, workforce. One thing that we're also going to hear a presentation by the Sunflower House people, the OIR, URO, INHS proposal. So I look forward to hearing about that from the housing point of view. And then we're going to dip our toe into a conversation about countywide code enforcement. And this is just an initial conversation. It's come up over the years a number of times. It came up at TCOG a couple of years ago. It came up at the Planning Advisory Board earlier this year. Tioga County had a very interesting, very comprehensive study done on this by CGR, the consultant firm that we've used in the past as well. And so I wanted to just to follow this up and see if there's interest among the committee to looking into that a little bit further. So so there's just the first conversation about that issue. So I can, I suppose, report on that discussion next month. So that's my report.
Thank you. Any questions for Martha and toe dipping? And coats? No. Okay. Downtown Facilities Committee, Dave McKenna, Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Downtown Facilities met on Thursday the 9th of this month. Main thing that we did was pass the resolution 10352, which allowed the use of fund balance to purchase properties at 300 and 308 Tioga Street. Beyond that, we had a pretty robust discussion of what we'd like to see done with both the Tioga Street property and this new property. And it looks like the committee is pretty much in favor of parceling off the one section of the parking lot there for two or three possible residences. And I think we'll be going to an RFP or at least an RFI in short order on that. Hey, Rich, have you got anything else?
No, I think you got it.
All right. Thank you, Dave. Any questions for Dave?
Okay, we will meet again on October 14th.
Oh, thank you. And Rich, you've already done your report for public safety. Health and Human Services Committee, Shauna Black, Chair.
Thank you. We met yesterday, September 20th, and we were informed by Amy Hendricks that municipal employees that that need COVID testing, as whether it be a part of the requirement from their municipality, or if they would just like to get tested, they will be covered under the county's testing. And essentially, we are able to get FEMA reimbursement for municipal employees. So that is good news. From what it sounds like, the city of Ithaca is setting up times and dates for their employees to get tested. And I believe the county is also doing something similar to that, so that it's convenient for our employees. Liddy Barger also joined us with some very good news from the Human Services Coalition. They received a $1.9 million grant to help with homeless youth in Tompkins County. And they were one of very few rural areas to receive this grant. And it really, $1.9 million is really an amazing award. And it's really going to help many of our youth population that finds themselves not having a home. So that was really great news. And then, of course, we passed a few resolutions that we voted on this evening.
All right. Questions for Shauna. Deb Dawson.
Thank you, Leslyn. Yeah, Shauna, I was just wondering if Kate Shink's booth is doing a happy dance over that $1.9 million for homeless youth.
She definitely is. Yeah, she was part of the grant writing for that. And I mean, everyone is doing a happy dance. You know, anytime we get grant funding is a great thing to celebrate. And especially for this cause, because I mean, we do have a good percentage of homeless youth. And what we were told is that despite the fact that our population is smaller and the size of our county is smaller, we actually got one of the bigger awards, which I don't know if that means that our population of homeless youth is greater than some of the other counties, but either way.
Our grant writers, pretty good.
Nailed it. Yeah, absolutely. So
that's great news. Thanks.
Yeah, really great.
All right. Definitely thanks to them, and thanks for focusing on this issue before it gets out of hand. Martha.
Yeah, thanks. Shauna, maybe you said this, but I might have missed it. Is the city requiring their employees to be vaccinated or get testing like we're doing, or is it?
That is my understanding, yes. Oh, I see Amy popped up. She can provide a better answer. I don't want to give wrong information.
The city is actually looking at mandating all employees to get tested, vaccinated or unvaccinated. So we're going to work through what the logistics of that would look like, what our FEMA reimbursable side would be for those who are unvaccinated. It wouldn't be a full testing for all employees in the business, though. We still have to work on the logistics, and that also expands to other municipalities. Every municipality is looking at different frequencies and different ways of doing this.
Is the city mandate, you know, expecting employees to be vaccinated or not? Or
I'm not
tested?
Sure.
Okay.
I'm not sure what their policy. I just know that they are looking at having all employees get regularly tested through a surveillance testing program, mm-hmm. Similar to what some of the higher ed institutions had been doing.
Okay. All right. Thank you. And just a quick word. I'm on the search committee for the Human Services Coalition executive director position. And just, you know, they're trying to really spread the word so that the posting is still open and we're, looking for candidates. Just wanted to make quick mention of that. Thank you.
Thank you. Anything else from you, Shauna, or any other
questions?
There are no member filed resolutions of the minutes of the previous meeting, September 7th. May I have someone move the minutes, please? Yes, you. Second, it's sideways. I can't see it. Seconded by Leslie Shell. Oh, my goodness gracious me. Any substantive changes to the minutes? No, let's vote on.
Dan Klein?
Yes.
Ann Corman?
Yes.
Mike Lane?
Yes.
Dave McKenna?
Yes.
Glenn Morey?
Yes.
Martha Robertson?
Yes.
Leslie Schill?
Yes.
Mike Sigler?
Yes.
Black?
Yes.
Amanda Champion?
Yes.
Deborah Dawson?
Yes.
New Granison?
Yes.
Rich John?
Yes.
Leslie McBean Claiborne?
Oh, yeah. Yes.
14 ayes, 0 noes.
It's getting to be that time of night where you can't pronounce or remember people's names. I need a motion to go into executive session. It's going to be quick to all for the purpose of potential real estate negotiations. Moved by Deb Dawson, seconded by Ann Corman. We are not going to be taking any action, so when we come out of executive session, we will be adjourning. So please let us know when we're shut down. Oh, I need a vote. We're going to executive session. Sorry.
Dan Klein?
Yes.
Foreman?
Yes.
Mike?
Yes.
Dave McKenna?
Yes.
Glenn Morey?
Yes.
Robertson?
Yes.
Leslie Shue?
Yes.
Yes.
Black?
Yes.
Amanda Champion?
Yes.
Austin?
Yes.
Henry Granison?
Yes.
Rich John?
Yes.
Leslie McBean Claiborne?
Yes.
14 ayes, 0 noes.
Okay.